Today we are talking about the weather's influence on United States presidential elections. Don't worry, this isn't a partisan podcast, merely an overview of how weather has affected or changed elections in the United States. We're going to look through some studies on weather and presidential elections. One study, published in 2007, entitled "Republicans Should Pray for Rain," was published in the Journal of Politics and studied 14 presidential elections ranging from 1948 to 2000, and they correlated voter participation to meteorological conditions. They found that rain significantly impacts voter turnout by almost 1% per inch of rain. Apparently, people are a little bit less afraid of snow, and I can attest to that given people's driving behavior in snowy conditions. Snow only reduces voter participation by 0.5% per inch of snow. They also found that adverse weather conditions tended to tilt the voter share in favor of Republicans more often than not, where Republicans received 2.5% more votes for each inch of rain. And weather seemed to be a determining factor in at least two of the 14 elections that they studied, and those were 1960 and 2000. They suggested in their study that in 1960, Richard Nixon could have been elected president 8 years sooner had it been very snowy or rainy on election day, since they hypothesized that he would have received an additional 106 electoral college votes. Building on that, adverse weather helps Republicans' hypothesis. States with clear weather that day that Nixon lost to John F. Kennedy were Delaware, Illinois, Minnesota, Missouri, New Jersey, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania. Now, more recently, it suggested that a dry election would have led to Bill Clinton winning North Carolina in 1992 and Al Gore to win the contested state of Florida in 2000. The authors of the article suggest that Al Gore winning Florida could have swung the election more in his favor, possibly leading to his victory. However, numerous other issues also contributed to the Florida outcome. If you remember that race, it was highly contested, with the butterfly ballots, overvoting, and the dreaded hanging chads. Ugh. Now, an article from the Weather Channel from November 2018 states that inclement weather tends to favor the incumbent of any race, whether it is presidential, the governor, or otherwise. It states that sunny days benefit challengers more than incumbents. The incumbent voters are going to get to the polls regardless. They also cite the above article that we already covered, that rain can influence voter choices, and elaborated that drizzle only keeps a few people away from the polls, whereas heavy downpours tend to keep greater amounts of voters away from the polls. They also say that temperatures can influence election turnout. A study they reference say that for every temperature increase of 1.8 degree Fahrenheit in a state, the voter turnout also increases by a little more than 0.1%. You're like, well, how is that? Well, keep in mind, Election Day is in November. Now, I found another blog post that describes temperature influence on voters, and they cite an article that for every 10 degrees C increase in temperature, voter turnout increases by 1.4% and generally will favor Democrats. But higher temperatures also seem to bring out support for alternate political parties such as Libertarians, Greens, and Independents, and warm temperatures seem to motivate them to vote for the incumbent once again. Interesting, like the person in power could be controlling the weather, something like that, I guess. Now, personally, the professors also experienced how weather influences voter turnout during the 2008 Maryland presidential primary, which is actually the influence that led me to make this podcast. The Democratic candidate was Barack Obama. He was running against Hillary Clinton for the nomination, and it was supposed by everyone that the Potomac area, that would be Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, would be a cinch for Senator Clinton. However, the weather, and it seems fate, had different plans. At the time, the professor was still commuting together with her dad, since we both were going across Chesapeake Bay Bridge from my hometown on the Eastern Shore. And fortunately, the professor's dad was smart enough to have them cast their both of our votes earlier that morning for the primary. By rush hour that evening, when the professor was headed home on Route 50 through Annapolis, the sleet and freezing rain was so bad that 50 was literally shut down for several hours. So we sat there listening to the radio for updates on the election, and that's how I learned that a Maryland judge had to extend voting statewide for 90 minutes until 9:30 p.m. And eventually the state troopers reopened the road, but it was definitely past the voting poll close time of 9:30. Again, it was very fortunate that the professor and her dad were able to and did vote prior to the workday. So the results on the Republican side, John McCain triumphed in Virginia, D.C., and Maryland. And on the Democratic side, Obama actually won decisive victories that day in all three primaries. I am convinced that weather played a role that day. Who knows? Perhaps with a dry, clear weather day, Clinton could have collected those votes from the Potomac. And who knows what kind of influence that would have had on the nomination. Now, really quick, a little background history here. Why is Election Day in November? This is something that I had to refresh myself about. So, Americans first began weekday voting back in 1845 when Congress passed a law designating the first Tuesday following the first Monday as Election Day in the month of November. Before this, states could hold their elections at any time they wanted between a 34-day window before the first Wednesday in December. That's when they wanted to have all the votes collected. Because this previous system led to influencing some of the later states' election results, because it's like, oh, well, they voted for so-and-so, and so we should vote for, like you're basically cheating on the test, so to speak, then Congress designated a specific day for everyone. So a bit of history as to why it is on specifically a Tuesday, because at that time most citizens worked as farmers and it could take as much as a day to travel to their local polling place. Lawmakers decided a 2-day window was needed and weekends wouldn't work because most people were in church on Sundays and Wednesday was market day for farmers. So the farming logic also applies to why November was chosen as our election day, because if election day was in the spring or the early summer, it could interfere with planting season. And if it's too late in the summer or early fall, then it would mess with the harvest time. So therefore, November was selected because most harvests were already complete and usually harsh winter weather had not arrived as of yet. Of course, I'm going to break that rule with the next couple of statistics for you. Let's talk extreme election day weather. Let's go for the hottest first. So, according to an article written by the Weather Channel in November 2016, the hottest official temperature on record for a presidential election day was 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Mohawk, Arizona. Now, this is by state, by the way, and this was November 4th, 1924. During that election, Republican President Calvin Coolidge was elected to a full term by defeating the Democratic candidate John W. Davis. Now, Coolidge was vice president under Harding and became president himself in 1923 when Harding died in office. But then he had to, get his own term. So Coolidge won 380 electoral votes, including the record hot Arizona that year. And now for the coldest weather. So the coldest weather on election day was recorded in Umatilla, Alaska, where it was 41 degrees below zero on November 6, 1984. In this election, Republican President Ronald Reagan was reelected for a second term, defeating Democrat Walter Mondale. This was also a historic election since Reagan had won 49 out of 50 states, becoming one of only two candidates to do so. The other was Nixon over McGovern in 1972. But of course, Alaska is cold on election day, right? isn't it winter there like 10 out of the 12 months of the year, you say? Okay, fine. So we'll throw out Alaska and say, okay, that's an outlier. So if we do that, then the coldest temperature recorded on a presidential election day in the lower 48 is 30 degrees below zero in West Yellowstone, Montana, on November 3rd, 1936, when Democrat FDR Franklin Delano Roosevelt won re-election by defeating the Republican candidate Alf Landon by a landslide of 523 electoral votes to only 8 electoral votes. That's embarrassing. So FDR only lost the states of Vermont and Maine, but he did get Montana, even though it was really cold. How interesting is that, right? So, which state has the highest snowfall record for presidential election day? That would be Wyoming. At Burgess Junction, Wyoming, November 3rd, 1992, the greatest election day snow was recorded of 22 inches. That's almost 2 feet of snow. In this election, Democratic candidate Bill Clinton was running against incumbent Republican George H.W. Bush, and although Bush got the snowy state that we were talking about, he didn't win the overall election. Now, speaking of snow, here's another crazy snowfall record on election day. In November 2000, when George W. Bush, that's George H.W. Bush's son, defeated Al Gore for his first term in office, Boys Ranch, Texas, received 12 inches of snow on election day, which actually beats the election day record snow for the state of Alaska. What? Yeah, that's right. The largest election day snow for Texas was this November 2000 with 12 inches. That's a foot of snow. And the largest election day snow for Alaska on record is 9.5 inches on November 2nd, 1976, which is interesting because in 1976, Democrat Jimmy Carter was running against the incumbent Gerald Ford, who was a Republican, and as stated in the studies above, Ford, the Republican, won Alaska, right, which had the snow, which goes with the studies that we covered, but it wasn't enough for him to beat Jimmy Carter. Okay, a brief kind of sidebar here. Let's talk about hurricanes. So these aren't necessarily on election day, but this is like during the course of the president's term in office. Please note that the record of hurricanes used here is only dating back to 1900. That's important because that's how long our records are for hurricanes. So the president saw that saw the most U.S. landfalling hurricanes was FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He saw 24 hurricanes make U.S. landfall during his presidency. Of course, technically that's cheating since he had 3 full terms in office. And then, so 6 years after FDR left office, the 22nd Amendment was ratified on February 27th, 1951, to establish a 2-term limit on presidents. So, he kind of had that coming for him, even though he was dead by the time it was passed. But anyway, as of the printing of the article, that I read, President Obama had the fewest landfalling U.S. hurricanes of any 2-term president because only 5 hurricanes made landfall during his presidency. Pretty crazy. Okay, so they got elected. Now what? Well, next comes Inauguration Day. And according to history.com's, why does Inauguration Day fall on January 20th? In case you didn't know, and I didn't remember from U.S. history class, I had to look it up. In the US, as much as 11 weeks can pass between Election Day and Inauguration Day. What gives? Well, our first president, George Washington's inauguration, was delayed because of bad weather by 8 weeks. However, for the incoming presidents and vice presidents at the time were also sworn at the same time. Following that, they took their oaths of office on March 3rd. Yes, 4 months used to pass between voting time and taking office time. And so this break was needed at that time because they had to count all the votes, they had to make sure they were all reported, and of course, traveling to the Capitol itself for inauguration took some time. There's no Amtrak back then, so it was all, horseback. So then there's all these problems that came up, like the secession winter of 1860, where seven states left the Union, and President-elect Abraham Lincoln had no power to act yet because he had not taken office, and the president leaving office, James Buchanan, chose not to do anything. How helpful of him. This period of time between voting and the oath of office was referred to as the lame duck period. So after technological advances shortened travel and made counting votes easier, this lame duck period of time wasn't needed anymore, leading to the lame duck amendment. That's kind of what was called in passing, but it's literally the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified on January 23rd, 1933, which designated Inauguration Day as January 20th going forward, and the first new Congress would meet on January 3rd. So, also, big secret, if January 20th is a Sunday, then swearing in actually happens privately, and then the public-facing oath of office is taken the next day. Bet you didn't know that. Okay, so now that we know that bit of information and refresh our memories, let's go through some weather statistics. The average high temperature for the capital of our nation on January 20th is generally 43 degrees Fahrenheit. The noon temperature, which generally when the swearing-in ceremony happens, is 37 degrees. Not too bad, right? Well, I have a story for you in just a minute, so hold on. But there's usually a chance, like 33% chance of precipitation for the day of, with a 10% chance that that would be snow, 16% chance of rain during the ceremony itself, and a 5% chance of snow during the ceremony. The first outdoor inauguration was held for President James Monroe in 1817. Now, let's get the worst of the worst out of the way to begin with. I'm going to warn you, it's really bad. So, tragedy strikes. Let's see just how bad it can get on Inauguration Day. So, the story I was teasing, do you know which U.S. president had the shortest term in office? Yeah, that would be William Henry Harrison. He spent only 31 days in office. Do you know why? Well, let's talk about the weather. On Inauguration Day in 1841, he was sworn into office on a cold, cloudy, and fairly windy day. Now, was this the only issue? No. Guess who also holds the record for the longest inauguration speech? That's right, William Henry Harrison. He had 8,445 words, lasting well over an hour and a half. He rode on horseback to and from the ceremony without a hat or coat. Is it any surprise that he caught a cold and later got pneumonia? He died a month later. It's sad. It is not funny. Tragically, this is not the only person who was claimed by Inauguration Day weather. In 1853, President Franklin Pierce was sworn into office on a day with very heavy snow that lasted until 11:30 a.m. Pierce began his speech, and the snow began again. Unfortunately, Abigail Fillmore, the first lady to the outgoing president, Millard Fillmore, caught a cold that later turned into pneumonia, and she also died a month after inauguration. Very sad. So, Inauguration Day can be deadly. Bundle up. All right, let's go for the hottest day. Okay, technically the hottest inauguration on record is Gerald Ford swearing in on August 9th, 1974. And you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You just told me that Inauguration Day was set to be January 20th. So, what's going on? Well, Richard Nixon resigned. So we had to replace him as president, and that would be his vice president, Gerald Ford, who was sworn in on August 9th, 1974. Now, we also have the times before inauguration was moved to January. So the warmest on record for the March date was officially Woodrow Wilson's with 55 degrees Fahrenheit in 1913 under overcast skies in DC. But unofficially, George Washington could hold the record for a March date with an estimated, since weather records began in 1871, 61 degrees Fahrenheit in Philadelphia, because that's where it was being held at the time. Now, the traditional date now of January 20th The warmest on record is Ronald Reagan in 1981 with 55 degrees Fahrenheit. Also in the top five warmest, according to the Washington Post, was Cleveland with 54 degrees Fahrenheit, March 4th, 1885. Then George H.W. Bush, January 20th, 1989, with 51 degrees Fahrenheit. And finally, Eisenhower, January 20th, 1953, with a temperature of 49 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, now we swing the other direction, the coldest. A fascinating fact is that while Reagan holds the warmest on record for January, he also holds the record coldest inauguration on record as well, January 20th, 1985, a significant year for the professor as well. But anyhow, Ronald Reagan was sworn in indoors. The parade was canceled. Why? Because the temperature was only 7 degrees above zero at noon. That's really chilly. And that morning, it was a very chilly 4 degrees below zero, and with the wind, it was very cold and brisk indeed. The coldest March inauguration on record was 1873 for Ulysses S. Grant's second inauguration. The morning low was 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which was a record for that month of March, and it remains the coldest March day on record for DC. Like the January record cold day, the wind was also quite blustery, gusting up to 40 miles per hour, which made it feel like more like 30 degrees below zero. Several cadets and midshipmen who were there for the parade, some without coats, actually collapsed. And the wind was so strong that even persons on the platform with the president, like the president's on the platform to give his address, he's talking, even people right next to him couldn't hear his address because of the wind. That's like really strong. Also, in the Washington Post top five, coldest inaugurations was January 20th, 1961 for John F. Kennedy with a temperature of 22 degrees Fahrenheit. Cleveland in March 4th, 1893 with 25 degrees Fahrenheit, and Obama January 20th, 2009 with a temperature of 28 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if we go with all inaugurations with temperatures below freezing, that's 32 degrees Fahrenheit. We can add Carter in 1977 with 28 degrees Fahrenheit and Roosevelt in 1941 with 29 degrees Fahrenheit. Interesting that the Post also points out that on Republican inauguration days, they're generally warmer with an average temperature of 39.3 degrees Fahrenheit compared to when Democrats have been inaugurated, which has an average of 33.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Interesting. Okay, let's talk the worst weather award for Inauguration Day. What was the Inauguration Day with the worst weather? Well, that would be for President William Taft in 1909. His ceremony was forced indoors due to a snowstorm that totaled 10 inches of snow with heavy winds that brought the city literally to a standstill. Trees and telephone poles came down, there were no trains, the streets were completely blanketed in snow. It took over 6,000 men and 500 wagons to clear over 58,000 tons of snow and slush from the planned parade route. The ceremony went on, but it was eventually forced indoors. Now, a close tie second, I would say, for worst weather would be the rainiest inauguration, which was FDR's second inauguration in 1937. Something about FDR and weather, right? Anyways, the first inauguration in January was held February 20th, 1937. So this is the first January inauguration, okay? So on this January 20th inauguration day, 200,000 people descend on the Capitol City. It's cold, it's rainy, even there's a little bit of sleet and some freezing rain that had been reported that morning. Just before and during the ceremony, about a little bit more than a half an inch of rain falls, even though the temperature hovered around 33 degrees Fahrenheit. The president insists on riding back to the White House in an open car, which led to the bottom of the car to gather like half an inch of water. Later, he then stood for the entire parade for a total of 90 minutes as the rain continues to drenched the attendees. The total rainfall for the day was 1.77 inches, which stands as the record for that date. Okay, so that's it, right? All the other inauguration days just went off without a hitch. But then there's the inauguration day of 1961. So a snowstorm comes, it dumps 8 inches of snow, causes the worst traffic jam for its time, where thousands of cars are abandoned just in the road, and President-elect John F. Kennedy struggles to keep several commitments, including the presidential dinner, who was reported to only have 4 hours of sleep. Yeah. And the former president, Herbert Hoover, was unable to attend because the airport was closed. Just like in 1909, they had an army that worked all night to clear Pennsylvania Avenue for the inauguration parade. The high temperature reached only a chilly 22 degrees Fahrenheit with brisk winds near 20 miles per hour. However, despite these conditions, a large crowd turned out for the ceremony and the parade. The data in this podcast came from the Journal of Politics article, "The Republicans Should Pray for Rain." The inauguration data came from an article by Katie McGraw at WDRB.com, Fox 41 in 2017, called "Most Dramatic, Tragic, and Extreme Inauguration Weather," and the National Weather Service. And I'd also like to thank History.com and the Weather Channel. So there you go. That's the history of weather and U.S. presidential elections and inauguration. Pretty interesting, right?